The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Sonia Yusech Kuhn of the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Community Connections. Every month, we will introduce you to people in the community who are making a difference. My guest today is Michael Elliott. Welcome, Michael. We are delighted that you can join us to provide and share information about you, your new book, and as a guest speaker at this year's North Carolina Reading Service Gala.
Thank you, Sonia. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the invite.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here are some interesting things today about today's guests. Michael Elliott, a native North Carolinian, was born a preemie on November 14, 1970, in Durham. He had cataracts in both eyes, was blind in his left eye, and for years had very limited vision in his right eye. Despite these limitations, he's been able to lead a happy, productive, and fulfilling life. Michael is a former radio veteran of more than 30 years, so he'll be very comfortable here. Encouraged by his wife, Elizabeth, he began writing. He is the author of the first biography of singer-songwriter John Hiatt. The book is titled Have a Little Faith, The John Hiatt Story, first published in 2021 by Chicago Review Press. The paperback edition came out this past September. Other writing has appeared in publications as diverse as Pop Matters, Albumism, Americana, UK, and The Bitter Southerner. The Governor Moorhead School played an important role in his life, as did Doctors Hedgepeth and Kobo, as well as technology. His career is presently with the State Capitol Police in downtown Raleigh. He and his wife, Elizabeth, also a radio vet, proudly volunteer for the North Carolina Reading Service as a small token of their appreciation for the tremendous support this community offers. Well, welcome, Michael.
Thank you, and thanks for having me again.
Given your situation with limited vision, tell our audience how it was growing up and about your early childhood experiences in public school.
Well, as you said in a very, very nice introduction, I was born premature, and I had cataracts in both eyes. They removed one, and after they removed one in my left eye, it never developed, and so I could never really see out of that except, and I still can't, other than maybe some shapes and light and things like that. But my right eye, they removed that cataract, but I still could not see very well. It was they did not remove that cataract, until a couple of years ago. So I grew up with a cataract on my right eye that really impeded the my ability to see in a very clear way. I had to get rid of the light around it as much as I could. So that meant I had to put my hands in front of my eyes so I could get rid of the light around my eye, so I could, like looking through a little peephole. That was the best way I could see. So I would sit in class, and I would have to sit at the front of the class so I could see the board, the chalkboard. Of course, a lot of times, me being shy, me being only child and having to squint all the time, it made me even shyer and very self-conscious. Mm-hmm. So I had to ask the teachers if I could sit at the front of the class if they didn't know already. But me being so shy, sometimes I didn't ask them. So they would put me in the back of the class, and I would just sit back there. And, you know, and my dad would find out, and he'd say, oh, no, you need to sit at the front of the class to let them know, you know. And so he would have to tell them at the first teacher conference. So that meant a couple of months would go by without me sitting up front. And, of course, then they had the green chalkboards with the yellow chalk. And so it was tough to see even then if you were sitting at the front, even if you had great vision. So it was just, it was a mess, but, I ended up, you know, working through it. And so, but thanks to the Governor Moorhead School, there, after probably around about the time I hit the fifth grade, they ended up getting me some, maybe fourth grade, if I remember correctly, but they got me some large print books, and I could see very well, you know, those very well, because the print was probably about 2 inches high. The issue with that, though, is because the books, the print was so large, that meant they had to come in several volumes, so I had to lug them around, you know, before we had lockers or anything like that. I had to keep them in classrooms or carry them around. And then if we had a teacher that liked to skip around, like, oh, today we'll do chapter 1, tomorrow we'll do chapter 20, I had to go back to my locker and get it and hold up the class and all that. But, I mean, those were small prices to pay. But at the same time, I was very self-conscious. Probably wasn't that big a deal. But I was thinking, oh, no, I have to hold the class up and all that. So those are some of the struggles I went through. And yeah, I got picked on and bullied some, you know. But and I couldn't see kids from across, you know, if they were anywhere beyond a few feet in front of me, I couldn't tell who they were. If we were like in a cafeteria or outside in a courtyard, and if they were waving, I didn't see them waving. And so a lot of people thought I was stuck up. Yes, exactly. So, well, I was waving at you. You didn't say anything. Well, I didn't see you. You know,
you were too young to be a snob, but old enough to be stuck up, right?
That's right. And of course, my name being Michael. I grew up at a time when that was like the most popular name in America when I was growing up. So if they yelled Mike or Michael, it could have been any number of them because I went to school with a lot of them. So I didn't think they were calling me. You know.
But did you wave anyway?
I mean, no. But I learned later that, you know, I've been a victim just like everybody has. When I see somebody waving at me, they're not really waving at me or waving at somebody behind me. I'll wave back and then I feel terrible because they're like – But that's what everybody goes through. But yeah, those were some of the challenges I had growing up. But you know, it wasn't all bad and sad. I mean, I had a very, very happy childhood, though, in spite of all that.
Well, one thing I do want to ask you about, because in America today, bullying is a very big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And were you bullied?
Well, you know, we called it picked on back then.
Picked on,
it wasn't really a bully. I think
did they make fun of you?
Yeah, they did. They were there was a bit of that, and I do not condone that, and I do not wish that upon anybody. It was not a fun time. I had some kids that would, but I grew to understand that some kids just did it because they didn't know any better, and sometimes kids just. Sometimes that's the way they bond, especially guys back then. Boys would sometimes bond by picking on each other. And so you had to differentiate between if they were being mean-spirited or if they were just
kidding around.
Yeah, kidding around trying to bond.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had a few that were actually mean-spirited, and, you know, you just learn to ignore them, and that's what I had to do. And you know, some folks go a little overboard, and that's when you just say that's enough, you know, and you just walk away. But yeah, I had a kid sit behind me in fifth grade that would poke me on the back. Sometimes I'd turn around and he'd put his hands up in front of his face like he was mocking me, you know. And so I had that going on some. But
it's sad that parents don't teach their children better manners.
Right. Right. And then you grow up and you think, well, you know, he probably had his own struggles. But you don't think about that when you're a kid.
No, not when you're seven.
No.
All right. So let's move on a little bit and tell me, how far did you go with your formal education and where did you study?
Well, I went to I ended up graduating from high school, J.F. Webb in Oxford. I went to school in Oxford my whole life. And so graduated in 1989, and after that I was going to go to broadcasting school. I went to community college for a little bit, went to Vance Granville Community College, and I was going to go to broadcasting school because I got a job right out of – while I was in high school, I got a job in radio. So I decided that's the field I wanted to go into because ever since I was a little kid, I would play radio in my house. I would take I had a little – cassette recorder, and I had a turntable, and I would slow, probably ruin the turntable, but I would slow it down and stop it and hold it and try to cue up records because I had a...
like a disc jockey.
Yes, yeah. I had a friend of mine, my parents had friends, were friends with people that owned the local radio station in Oxford. And I would go there and sit with, the guy that ran the station and the morning guy. And I used to sit and crawl around under his feet and look at the wires and how they were plugged in. And I watched him cue up the records and play them and all that. And of course around that same time, WKRP in Cincinnati was big on TV, and I watched that, so it looked just like the studio at WCBQ is where it was in Oxford. And Dr. Johnny Fever on there was a big hero of mine, you know, as probably most radio kids were back then. And so that really got me interested in radio. So I decided, well, I'm going to start working. So I started working there part-time when I got old enough. You know,
what did you do there?
I started running the board. I would run ball games, the typical stuff that a radio person does when they first start out. I would run the satellite and the ball games. And then I would run the – they had old-fashioned automation, which was they had four reel-to-reels, and they were they could turn on by themselves, and you'd have to program it in. But each reel would start after the other one stopped, and then they had cart machine. They had a carousel that would turn automatically and put the cart in, but you could stop it. You could
did some kind of grunt work in beginning. Okay.
Yes.
Tell me, were you on the air? You have a beautiful radio voice.
Well, thank you. But what would happen was I would hit the stop button, which just like nowadays in computer automation, if you hit the stop button, it wouldn't stop automatically. It would stop at the end of the event. So we had these reel to reels, and I would hit the stop button, and it would play the song. And at the end of the song, the reel would stop. I would come on the air and read the time and temperature and do a little jockeying, even though it wasn't in my job description. The boss was a very understanding guy, thank goodness. And he would say, I hear you on there trying to DJ. but I grew up listening to all these DJs. There was this radio station in Raleigh that I was obsessed with. It was WQDR 94.7. And of course, now they're a country station, but back then they were album rock. And I listened to one of the guys here at North Carolina Reading Service, Tom Guild. I listened to him all the time as a kid. And he would probably die if he knew I was but he was on the – I was a little kid, and he was on the air. And so I would listen to him and all his – all the folks that worked with him. And I think he was the PD, the program director for a while there. And I would listen to how they talked. I would listen to how they announced things. And so that just learned to talk like them.
So you didn't have to go to broadcast school.
That I went off on a side road. My wife told me, I get off on tangents sometimes. So I did all that.
Okay.
Started in radio, I was still in high school. I got out of high school. I decided, well, I'll go to community college, business administration, to make my dad happy, because he said you got to have something to fall back on. So I thought about going to broadcasting school down in Sanford. And so I had a friend of mine who worked at – I started working in Henderson at a radio station. And he said, well, I went to that same school. And he said the first day I was in there, I asked the person teaching the school, I said, what do I get at the end of this course? He said, you will be able to have – a third class radio operator license. He said, I have that hanging on the wall back at the radio station right now. He said, so sayonara. So he left, and I said, okay, well, if that's the case, then I don't see the need of me wasting money going there. So I just did on-the-job training, and that's the end of my formal education was after I graduated high school and went to a semester advanced Granville Community College. I just went straight on into work.
So 30 years is a long time in broadcasting.
Yes.
Did you have your own show?
Yes, I did.
Briefly.
Well, actually I did. I did every imaginable shift. So I would do the morning show, afternoon show, evening show, overnight show. And then throughout the whole tenure, I did news. That's where I first started when I moved to the second station in Henderson. I started as a news guy. And then from there, I did the morning show for a while. And then I ended up doing a talk show. I did, it was called Town Talk, and I did that for many years, probably about 10 years. And we also had, as in small town radio station heads, we had a radio trade program called Tradio. And so people would call in and buy, sell, trade and stuff like that. So I had that show as well. And then I moved to, years later, I moved to FM. And while I was in Henderson, I became the program director there. And that's how I ended up being in administration. And so I moved from being a jock to being program director, and then eventually moved up to FM and operations management. And but I had a variety of shows over the years. I had a blues music show.
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you for telling us all about that.
No problem.
So now let's get back to a little bit of your medical life with doctors Hedgepeth and Kobo.
Yes.
Can you just describe how they affected you, what their role was?
Dr. Hedgepeth was my doctor ever since I was a little kid. He was the first doctor I remember being attentive to my eyes, and he was apparently very fascinated with my case. He would call in people to other doctors to look at my situation and tell them what was going on, and then he would take my case and take it to conferences and tell them what was going on with my cataract and how I could see, because I could see 20/80, 20/60 with it. It was just the light was the issue, you know, That's what he was saying I saw 2200 or so in my left eye, I believe was what the last thing I remember getting measured. But I saw relatively better with my right eye. But he did not want to remove the cataract because he said it was back then. He said it was too much of a risk, that if they took my cataract off my right eye, that he didn't want to risk that happening or anything bad happening, because it was the only sight I had. So it wasn't until I was 18 years old, and so I did not drive or anything like that. So by the time I was 18 years old, we decided to try out another doctor, because my original doctor was on the verge of retirement. And so we were going to a different doctor. His name was Dr. Kobo out of Duke. And he asked me, he said, do you ever have, when you leave the eye doctor, do you see better? And I said, well, maybe for about a half hour, I do see better. I never thought of that. But when I leave the eye doctor, I see leaves on trees and things like that. He said, well, that's because your eye is dilated, and there's more light in around the eye. And so what they do is they give you those dilation drops so the doctor can see your eye better. What if we gave you these eye drops, and we have eye drops that could last for a day or 2 days instead of just 30 minutes? And I said, that would be amazing. So he did that, and that basically changed my life. And so I had to take these eye drops, but I could drive, I could do everything anybody else could do that had sight, you know. And so that basically was how I got to live a fulfilling life, in my opinion. But
do you still take the drops?
Well, and when I turned probably around 40 years old or so, they stopped making those drops, but they ended up getting another set for me but I had to put them in my eyes every hour and a half to 2 hours. So that changed a lot. So I had, and it was always a situation where they're almost out. It's a Friday afternoon and I have to run, and they haven't filled his prescription. So I would go for a weekend without them, you know, and I would be back to my old self. So it was always a struggle. And then I talked with a Dr. Herndon in when I was 50 years old. At Duke, he ended up working with me, and he took I had LASIK surgery. He removed the cataract and put in a lens at 50 years old. So I've been able to go without eye drops ever since then. And of course, I have to wear reading glasses now, but I never had to, you know,
me
I never
too.
Had to do that. Yeah, exactly. So there you go. That's the trade-off.
It's not a bad trade-off.
No, it's not.
Okay. Well, let's move on and tell me and our listening audience, what does your work with the State Capitol Police involve?
My work with the State Capitol Police involves me. I'm the Director of Communications. And so I started in 911 after I left radio. I started in as a dispatcher for Granville County and went to Raleigh. From there and worked for the city of Raleigh 911, and then from there went to State Capitol Police. I moved from State Capitol Police from Raleigh 911 because it's a lot less stressful than having to answer 911 calls from all over the city and county. But you know, I'm a little. I really enjoy the work, but you know, I'm not a young kid anymore and can't put up with that amount of constant calling, but I can really help people when you know, more laid back situation. But with them, I'm Director of Communications. I oversee the telecommunicators and the dispatchers in that area, and also in charge of all the radios at the at State Capitol Police. So
that's
again,
important. That's really important.
I'm still working for the FCC after all these years.
Okay, well, now we know what you do, and you're taking care of everybody who needs a 911 help. Then, you know, that's a lot, fire and illness. And
it's state government employees and state buildings in downtown, and if anybody needs medical assistance or law enforcement assistance,
right,
we try to get it to them.
Okay. So now I want to talk a little bit about your writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems very prominent in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It was your wife who encouraged you to start writing.
Yes.
And you've been published in several magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me and everybody, what was the content of those writings? Was it poetry, short story, essay?
Well, ever since I was a kid and wanted to be a DJ, I was also obsessed with music. So I would listen to music and I would write about it sometimes. And I would just be obsessed with writing about and learning about all things music. And so
I'm going to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
We don't have that much time left, and I want to I want you to talk about how you came to write. Have a little faith. Did you know John Hyatt? Tell us about his music. And we only have 5 minutes left. So you're going to give me the quick Hyatt.
Gotcha. The elevator pitch. So I had never met John Hyatt, but I was always a big fan of his. And so I decided after I started writing at the urge of my wife, because she said I was a great writer and I should do something with, you know, my time when I'm working overnights at State Capitol Police or whatever, and I was doing the night shifts and wasn't much to do, so I started writing, and I started pitching the idea of writing about this artist that I love so much. I found out he never had a book written about him. He never had a biography. So I thought, well, he has an amazing story to tell, one of resilience, and he overcame alcoholism and all kinds of drug problems to become and it was an amazing story for the fact that when he got sober, a lot of times in the art world or in the music world, when people get sober, that people feel like their music it takes a hit, you know, that they're more creative when they're on drugs or alcohol. But that's not the case with him. When he became sober, his music became better, and it became more pointed and more confessional and more relatable. And so I wanted to tell that story, so I sat down and started writing up a proposal, and a publisher took interest in it, and amazingly, all the people that love John Hyatt in the music world, he's from Bonnie Raitt to Ryan Cooter, to a lot of people who are huge in the music business, Elvis Costello, and they were very happy that somebody was taking the time to finally write a biography about him.
So where is it available?
It's available on Amazon.com, of course, and in all your local bookstores, which I urge you to frequent.
Is it at Quail Ridge?
It's at Quail Ridge. As a matter of fact, I got a copy right now, I think, unless somebody's bought it. But yeah, all around. So you can order it online, or you can buy it from a store. They'll special order it if they need to.
Okay. So now we're going to get to the crux of North Carolina Reading Service. Mm-hmm. This year, after 2 or 3 years of not having a gala due to COVID, you were the guest speaker.
Well,
how was that?
I don't know why, but I would. No, I was very, very honored to be the speaker at the gala, and I was I hope I did you justice, it was a wonderful honor. It was an amazing night. I got to tell my story in front of folks who really support the North Carolina Reading Service, and I felt like I was among, for lack of a better term, my people. You know,
yes.
So it was kind of like full circle from a long time from being a little kid, not being able to see to now being able to share my story with everyone else.
That's fantastic. I was there and I listened to you, and you were wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay. If you could, in one sentence, offer some advice to our listening audience who have sighted problems, and maybe something for the families who support them.
I would say to use Jim Valvano's phrase, don't ever give up. There's nothing to be ashamed of. There are many, many, many people who have done great things, no matter what they have. If they have limited vision, look at Ray Charles, look at Ronnie Millsap, who went to GMS himself, and look at all the great musicians that have conquered the world with what people may call limited vision. So I say just keep at it. What you love doing, keep doing it, and people will enjoy it.
Okay. So now I'm going to say this. A combination of perseverance, fortitude, and passion seem to be the ingredients of successful people. Just tell me, in a few words, your personal thoughts on compassion.
Compassion is...
Passion.
Passion. Oh, sorry. Passion is what drives us to do what we love to do, and also it drives us to be better people. I believe without a passion, you could be rudderless. And so you should, if you don't have a passion yet, just look for one, because it'll help you, it'll brighten your day, and it'll give you something to look forward to.
Okay. You are inspirational. Thank you so much for enlightening us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time for this month's episode of Community Connections. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. I'm Sonia Yusech-Kuhn for the North Carolina Reading Service. Community Connections is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments, questions, or would like to be a sponsor of Community Connections, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.